Get ready for a high adventure with the new children's adventure series, The Only Living Boy. Harvey Award winners David Gallagher and Steve Ellis' critically acclaimed web series to print is now a riveting graphic novel exclusively from Papercuts. When Eric runs away from home, he finds himself lost, without his memory, on a patchwork planet under a broken moon. He may be the only living boy, but he's not alone. The world is filled with dangerous creatures fighting to decide who is the hunter and who is the hunted. He'll need help from mermaid warrior Morgan and Thea, an insect princess, to escape the foes pitted against them by the dreaded Lord Balakar and fiendish Dr. Once. Can Eric defeat their evil plans and find his way home? Mental Floss calls The Only Living Boy an all-ages adventure book inspired by pulp serials, Saturday morning cartoons, Jack Kirby, and even the music of Paul Simon. The Only Living Boy, Volume 1, Prisoner of the Patchwork Planet, is on sale in bookstores everywhere on March 8th. Learn more at olbcomic.com.
As a foul sty. Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine?
I don't want you to touch my mother. So go away, I'm warning you. Go away or I'll kill you myself. Your hands! Oh, let me go, Uncle Charlie! Let me go!
Welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am, of course, your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's 1943 classic, Shadow of a Doubt, is our pal, Ange. Ange, thank you for doing the show.
As always, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm a huge movie buff, and so I feel honored to be a guest host.
Oh, very cool, very cool. I asked Ange about being on the show, and as I do with pretty much everybody, I say, what movies would you like to talk about? You know, not necessarily one that you love, but just one that you have strong feelings about, you want to talk about. And this was this film, Shadow of a Doubt, was on the near the top of Ange's list. So a very brief plot description. I'll just read it off of IMDb. And this does not even hint at what the movie's really about, but it's a young woman discovers her visiting Uncle Charlie may not be the man he seems to be. It stars Teresa Wright as the young woman named Charlie. She is the namesake of her Uncle Charlie, played by Joseph Cotten. Uncle Charlie's sister is played by Patricia Collins. Her husband is Henry Travers, who was in The Invisible Man. There's a weird kind of friend named Herbie Hawkins, played by Hume Cronin. And then a bunch of other really solid character actors, including one that I'm going to go out of my way to mention when we get to it. This film, later on in the 60s, when Alfred Hitchcock was interviewed about his career, called this his favorite film of all of his films. And, you know, when I had first heard that quote, I thought, well, that's a really high compliment, but it depends when he said it. You know, if he had said it in 1946, he still had a bunch of classics ahead of him. But he said it in 1966, and then he repeated it again in 1972. So this is quite a compliment for someone who produced Psycho, Vertigo, Rear Window, To Catch a Thief, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Suspicion, Lifeboat, Spellbound, to call this film his favorite. And this is one of his, you know, sort of least known of all of his Hitchcock films. So Ange, why did you suggest this movie? Why do you love it so much?
There are so many layers about this movie that I love that this might take up the entire episode.
Oh, good. Go right ahead.
So the first thing I'll say is that, you know, I saw this movie. This was one of the later Hitchcock movies that I saw. And, you know, when you start to watch films, you're like, oh, I love Psycho because there's a guy in a dress who stabs somebody to death and there's a, you know, mummified mom in the basement, which is sort of like almost superficial. There are great things about that movie, no doubt. And then, you know, the next one I saw was The Birds, which was like great because, you know, somebody's eyes get pecked out. And then, you know, as I got older and became more of a, like a student of film, you see this one, or I saw this one, and I was just really amazed. I think this was the first time that I really said, I understand what a Hitchcock movie is. It's not people getting stabbed necessarily. There's layers on layers. And so this movie, there's, you know, this layer of trying to, you know, understand that in the world there is this simple country life, and that is juxtaposed with really this seedy underbelly of evil, right? So it's sort of, it reminds me of a retro David Lynch movie, that there is this small town feel that everything is just like wonderful. And then in this small town now is this, you know, serial killer. And people have a hard time sort of coming to grips with that. So that's one thing. You know, he plays Uncle Charlie. She plays his niece Charlie. They're named after each other. And so there's this whole, you know, look at their characters in terms of how are they similar? How are they different? How do we see, any of his malevolence in her, you know, and how did he get to be that way when we know what she's like, what the family's like, what the mom is like? That's his sister, which also I find extremely fascinating. But to be honest, one of the things that I really love about this movie is there's one scene that is sort of a blink if you miss it, like 5 seconds, that is, you know, like Hitchcock has these great shots that just, you know, sear themselves onto your brain if you're a movie fan. And there's this one scene in this movie that I can talk about now if you want, that really, I looked at it and I said, wow, I totally understand what he was trying to say when he filmed it that way. And for me, that was kind of when I said, I've gone beyond just like kicking back, eating popcorn. I'm now trying to sort of understand the mechanics of points of view and things like that. So this really is a movie that I feel sort of, you know, was a transition point for me going from like a movie fan to like a film fan, if that makes any sense.
Oh no, that makes complete sense. Now I am going to ask you what that scene is, because I have a specific scene that I want to mention, and I'm wondering if it's the same scene. But before we do that, I will mention to everybody, just for anyone who hasn't seen it, the bigger version of the plot is basically, it opens with Joseph Cotten. He is being pursued by these two men. We don't exactly know why. He gives them the slip, and he decides to take up residence in this small California town, sort of out of the way, get away from the pursuit of these two people. You get the sense they're policemen, but you don't know that. And he decides to go and visit his sister and their family live in I think it's Santa Rosa, California. And there's the mother, the father, there's two very small children, and then there's the older daughter, who's played by Teresa Wright. She is Uncle Charlie's namesake, and she is kind of like a super early goth girl. She doesn't look that way. Teresa Wright was incredibly wholesome. But in her opening scene, she's laying on the bed complaining that, like, nothing ever goes on in this town, and that her family really don't talk to one another, like real people. It's all surface. She's kind of like, you know, I'm dropping truth bombs on all you people, you know? And this is pretty startling kind of dialogue for 1943. So that's kind of the thing. So then Uncle Charlie shows up, and he is as played by Joseph Cotten, one of my favorite actors. He's very sarcastic and very flinty and very kind of who the hell cares about being all that polite. And his namesake, Charlie, really takes to him. And they form a bond that, as you get to realize that, okay, maybe Uncle Charlie is as bad as these police seem to think he is, you start to worry, how much is she taking after him? And then there is a scene where to get out of going out with a girlfriend of hers, Charlie, the young Charlie, just lies to her friend about why she can't go. And she does it with nary a hesitation. And I remember that scene thinking, uh-oh, Charlie's just starting to pick up some of her uncle's bad habits, because she lies to her friend just completely and doesn't even worry about it. And the parents call her on it. The parents are sort of like, are you lying to your friend? And she's like, yeah, it's no big deal. And just there's just that little like, oh boy, is Teresa Wright getting corrupted here? But that's the basic story structure. So now, what is this scene that you're referring to?
You know, he turns out, I mean, I guess, you know, whatever this is, 70 plus years of spoilers, right? You know,
I think we all can deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah. He turns out to be a serial killer, right? So he has been killing widows, right, who are frittering away the money that their husbands left them, and he finds that objectionable. And
he sure does.
Right. And it turns out that, you know, the police are following two people. One is Uncle Charlie and one is this other guy out east. And they're not sure which one is the serial killer. And at some point we learn that the guy out east was being pursued by the police, ran into an airplane propeller and was killed. And they assume that him running away means that he was the Merry Widow killer. And so they're probably going to call up the investigation. And you see Joseph Cotton, who is also one of my absolute favorite actors of all time.
Yep.
He just is overwhelmingly thrilled, right? Because he thinks that he's out now. And
right.
So the music plays this very uplifting music. Yeah, and he runs up the staircase giddy, almost like a kid, because he thinks that he's escaped. But by this time, Charlie, played by Teresa Wright, has figured out that he actually is the killer through a number of clues. And he turns around and looks down the staircase and sees her in the front doorway. And she is, it's, you know, filmed from the top of the stairs. So she's small. She's surrounded by the door, then surrounded by a lot of the wall of the door. And then it's framed by sort of the banister of the staircase. It's a very claustrophobic shot. And for me, it kind of, it says he realizes that he's still trapped by her. Like there's this sense of imprisonment and she's right there at the key. She's the crucial part of him being trapped like that. And all of a sudden that music ends. And then 2 seconds later, you see him in his bedroom and he's got his hands almost like clawed, like, you know, and they're shaking a little bit like he's going to throttle her. So that scene of her tiny in this sort of claustrophobic shot always struck me as being, boy, he went from being exuberantly happy to understanding that he's actually still trapped because she knows more. And that's when the film sort of takes this even darker turn where he starts to try to kill her because he's afraid that she's going to end up, exposing who he really is.
Yeah, that is a tremendous scene. And Hitchcock gets a lot of mileage out of that staircase.
Yeah.
And it's got the bars on it. So it looks when you cast the light behind it, it looks like prison bars. I mean, it looks like that drapery that you see in all the private detective movies that are always casting those weird shadows on walls, and he uses that in the house. This film really is one of the early ones to suggest that not everything in suburbia during the war is all peaches and cream, and there's a lot of darkness and things like that. And yeah, and Cotton is terrific. I first saw him in Citizen Kane, and then I followed him in other movies, and I've always loved him. I just think he's just such a great character actor, and he's tremendous here. I always wonder why Hitchcock never used him again, or Teresa Wright, for that matter, considering how much he seemed to love both their, you know, if he thought this was his best movie, he must have thought those performances are pretty good because they are the leads here.
Like, I discovered Joe Cotton, really, my favorite role by him is in The Third Man. And he kind of plays a bumbling guy in that movie. Like, he's reacting, not really acting in that movie. And in this movie, you just get a sense right from the beginning that there's an underlying malevolence in him. But as you say, you don't kind of, you don't really know exactly what it is until you're about halfway through the movie. And at first he comes off like he's joking, right? Like, oh, here's a bank. This is where they embezzle your money. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, don't say that. And he's like, I don't care. Right? So there is this flippancy about him. But the more the movie goes on and the more he starts to say things like that, you start to think, maybe he's not joking. Maybe he really has this sort of antisocial feel to him. And then he gives that famous speech at the dinner where he talks about widows and what they do. And you go, oh boy, you know, this isn't him being flippant. He's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, he compares them to animals that deserve to be slaughtered. And that's when Hitchcock does this very slow push in until the point where basically the whole screen is filled with Cotton's face. And then when he realizes that he's kind of gone on this rant, he turns to the camera, which is where Teresa Wright is looking. And, you know, all of a sudden you're face to face with Joseph Cotton and sort of his most murderous kind of feeling. And it really, you know, makes everybody freak out a little, like, whoa, what is this guy doing? Yeah. The scene that you refer to in the bank where he goes to deposit some money, and he is so flippant about everybody there, and he just seems to not care. And yet he's, you know, they talk about, you know, where'd you get that money? And he's like, oh, there's always money you can find. You just got to know where to look. You know, he's thumbing his nose at all of these people and their little small town pretensions. And yet it's like he wants to hide there. He wants to blend in, but he can't help himself. You know,
yeah.
he can't help but stand out, even though he needs to lay low because the cops are after him. And in fact, there are end up being two private detectives that come to the town that chase after him. One of them is played by McDonald Carey, who plays a guy named Jack, and he sort of falls in love with young Charlie, although I don't know if he really does or not. I get this. Did you ever get a sense whether when he's making all the romantic talk to her that he's BSing her to get to Charlie, or do you think he's genuine?
You know, for me, that romance almost feels like it didn't even need to be part of the movie. I just wonder if back then there had to be a romance in movies. Like, you know, there's the romance plotline in the Caine Mutiny that when I watched that movie, I'm like, why is that plotline here? It takes away. It just drains the life out of it. So when I watched this movie again for this podcast, and I thought the same thing. I'm thinking he needs information from her, and because how can you? He talks about, you know, that moment I first saw you under that streetlight is when I knew that I loved you, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to barf. So I do wonder if he's just trying to reel her in a little bit so that he can capture Uncle Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, there is a scene that after he leaves town, she tries to call him again when she gets another suspicion, but Charlie, and she can't get a hold of him. She keeps calling all these precincts, and they're like, he's not here. And you're like, well, he seems like he just split on her. And so that made me think. Now, the final scene of the movie does feature them, so maybe, you know, he is genuine. But I never fully understood necessarily. Not that it would have a hard time falling in love with Teresa Wright. I always loved Teresa Wright. She's kind of a – I don't know. I've seen her criticized in sort of film books as kind of more of a bland presence. But I love her in all the movies I've seen her in. She is in the Best Years of Our Lives, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. And she's in Pride of the Yankees with Gary Cooper. I think she's terrific. And that's part of the thing. The reason I do love this movie, I think, on top of it just being a great Hitchcock movie, is that it features two stars that I just enjoy watching.
Yeah, you know, she strikes me as kind of like Jean Tierney, but the girl next door version.
Yes, right? Yes, like, very much so.
Like, I might have a shot with Teresa Wright. Gene Tierney's out of my
mind. There's no chance you have a Gene Tierney. Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's funny you mentioned that your scene, because that was not the scene I was thinking of. And I wanted to mention, because, you know, in a lot of these Hitchcock movies, he, of course, has one or two scenes where you're like, how the hell did he do that? And the scene I'm thinking of is when the aforementioned Jack Graham and McDonald Carey comes to visit. And they come under the pretense that they are doing they're reporters, and they're doing a story about like an all-American family, and they want to come and take pictures of the house to kind of just figure out this is what all-American family looks like. And of course it's all a ruse to get to Charlie, but they have to pretend. And there's a shot of them, and the camera follows Jack and the mother, again played by Patricia Collins, down the steps. And he's talking to the mother, and he's trying to convince her, all right, I'll come back. We won't disturb anything. We'll come back with the photographer, and we'll take pictures. And you're looking at McDonald Carey, and then the camera pans back, and you realize that this whole shot has been through the glass of the front door. Because all of a sudden, we're on the opposite side of the door, which the character then opens in front of us. And the door has drapes on it. And I'm like, wait, how did we see through it? Like, I still can't figure it out. I watched that scene on repeat about a dozen times. I could not figure out how we did it. And this is a 1943 technology with no computers. It was just simply a neat camera trick. And I still am like, how the hell did he do that? Because the curtains are there, and then they're not there, and then they are there. The door opens. It's all one smooth shot. I was so impressed by that. It's just Hitchcock having fun.
Yeah, I mean he's just a master. You know, there was a similar scene at the end of Foreign Correspondent where the plane crashes and the water comes into the plane.
Right,
That for the longest time I was like, how the heck did he do that back then?
Yeah.
And then, in some documentary I saw, he explained how they did it where it was rice paper that they were filming the ocean on, and he had two huge vats of water behind it that he just dumped. And you go, boy, that's just, you know, brilliant for that period. So, I don't know how we did that shot in this movie either, but God bless him, right?
Yeah, really.
There are always these shots like this in his movies, right? Like in Notorious when he zooms all the way into the key in her hand that you're like, wow, he's, you know, there's usually for me like one shot that just stands out as, you know, above all, even though the whole movie is just wonderful.
Right. I can't imagine what audience's reaction must have been to some of these shots, because you just didn't see stuff like this. You know, it must have just been such a strange thing to mess with your mind. And speaking of messing with your mind, apparently originally Hitchcock wanted to cast Cary Grant as the murderer, Uncle Charlie, which would have been such a mind F to audiences if they had gotten Cary Grant to play this. I mean, it would have been, you know, all American hero Cary Grant, and then he ends up being a murderer. I mean, I know that they end up using Cary Grant as murderer in the Notorious, but, you know, or Suspicion. No, Notorious.
Notorious, yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't like Cary Grant never did that, but in 1943, that still would have been pretty out there to cast Cary Grant. And it's, you know, and it's, of course, in this movie, he is a murderer. So having Cary Grant be a murderer, I can only imagine the studios were like, no, Hitch, we're not doing that. We're not doing that.
Yeah, you know, I think that I watch Turner Classic Movies a lot, and they mention him as being up for so many roles that I'm like, I can't imagine him playing that. To be, you know, I recently watched, again, The Third Man on TCM, and they said he was up for that role, the Joseph Cotton role. And I go, boy, he's just too suave to play the bumbling character in that, just like he's too good guy to be the Merry Widow murderer in this one.
Yeah, so. I'm trying to picture Cary Grant delivering that speech about the fat animalistic.
Wheezing animals that deserve ill
threats. Yeah. Now, there are a lot of I did some reading about this movie afterwards, because I just wasn't as familiar with this one until I started watching it again upon Ange's recommendation that we talk about it, is that there's a lot of duality in this movie. There are a lot of twos here. There are two Charlies, young Charlie and Uncle Charlie. The father and his best friend, played by Hume Cronin, are kind of a pair, because they are constantly distracted by talking about their crime fiction that they like to read. They're in like a little club together, and they like to guess how you could kill people and get away with it. So they have their own little thing. There's all this. There are two train scenes. The film starts on a train and opens with a train scene, ends with a train scene. And there's a lot of that. I don't really know. I can't say to what necessarily all that meant, other than just the fact that, you know, in this beautiful sunlit town of California, there is a whole other layer that you're not seeing. And I guess that is just the, you know, maybe it's something more than simply the shadow and the light. It's just it's Hitchcock is suggesting that there are two sides to virtually any sort of equation.
Yeah. You know, and I think that also sort of plays in with what we said, you know, these two layers of like evil in this little town, right? So these two guys that are talking about, hey, I slipped a little club soda in your tea tonight. You didn't even notice it. I could have killed you. And Charlie is thinking, you know, how can you joke about that when, you know, up the stairs is the guy that I know has killed eight women, right?
Yep,
you know, this isn't a laughing matter. And then again, there's sort of that duality between the two Charlies. So even part of the ways that those characters were shot is very similar. So, you know, you talked about the opening shot of her, she's lying on the bed. Well, the opening shot of him, he's also lying on a bed.
Right.
The exact same shot, right? And when they meet on the train afterwards, the shot of them running to each other, the exact same shot. So there is this sort of feeling of, you know, are these two sides of humanity, or these two Charlies, and which will win out? And like you said, you know, she lies to her friends at that one point. But later on, she tells Uncle Charlie that if he doesn't leave town, she'll kill him. And you say, oh boy, you know, she went from being what I felt was this like all-American girl, maybe with these like feelings of being tied down in this town, to, you know, suddenly I believed her when she said that. And then you say, boy, maybe the apple didn't fall too far from the tree after all.
It said in this family, there's the mother, played by Patricia Collins. Now, she has a seemingly very odd relationship with her brother. It borders on obsessive. I'm guessing that they're hinting at that she's bored because her husband seems to want to spend more time with Hume Cronin than he does maybe with his wife. But there's at the end of the movie where Charlie says, Uncle Charlie says he's going to leave now. We know for him, things have gotten too hot and he's got to get out of town, but he makes up a story as to why he's leaving. He met another woman and we know he's going to end up murdering her, but he's going to leave town. And there's a scene where they're all in the whole family and a bunch of friends are at their house. And the mother sits in this chair and almost has a complete mental breakdown talking about how much she's going to miss her brother and how she can't live without him. And it's really very frightening. It's really strange, and it's not really commented on. Everyone just kind of looks, and the scene moves on. But it's an amazing little moment for this actress, Patricia Collins, who I'm not familiar with. But she's great in it, and you just know there's something really wrong that she is so focused on this brother. Like, why is she just cannot – she has to have him in her life.
Yeah, and she talks about it from the very beginning that, you know, there's one picture that exists of him because he doesn't want to be photographed.
Right, that's a recurring thing about he doesn't want to get photos taken of him.
Yeah, and it's him as, like, I don't know, a five-year-old kid. And she talks about how from the very beginning he was always so beautiful and that life that we lived together was so beautiful and it was so much more wonderful when he was in my life. And then, again, as you say, that scene at the end is a little bit weird. You know, I mean, she's openly weeping at this, what I think was a party, right? They had just come back from some speech that somebody was doing.
Yeah, yep.
And there's like this get together and she's suddenly very maudlin about the whole thing. And I don't know, you know, as I've tried to wrap my head around that as well, I just wonder if it was supposed to show like how charismatic he was, that maybe he could lure these women into his life to then off them, you know, because if his own sister felt compelled to be with him, maybe that's why these rich widows will suddenly bring him into their lives. But it is a very powerful scene by her, and it is a little bit off-putting. It does seem to come out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think now that you say it, I think you're right. That's how he's able to charm so many women, because he seems to have no problem. They call him the Merry Widow Killer, and he seems to have no problem meeting women. And said at the end of the film, we see him wave to another woman on the train, and you know that he's met yet another woman. And Teresa Wright's character sees that too and just knows, well, this woman's marked for death. I got to stop this because she's going to end up being the next dead widow.
Yeah, before you hear or before they reveal that that's who he is. At that scene in the bank, he meets a widow. I don't know if you recall that. He's in the office.
That's right.
Yeah. He's in the office to give like money to start an account. And this widow walks in and he like stands up and takes her hand. And it's very, very charming. Which when you see, you know, at the first time I saw the movie, I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. But then later on, when, you know, you watch it again, you see, oh boy, it's like you say, he wants to hide out in this small town, but he immediately becomes Prince Charming to this woman who talks about, like, I don't have to ask my husband anymore for money. I just spend it. And you go, boy, if he stayed in town, you know,
yeah,
look
she
out.
Was, yep. And it is a testament to Joseph Cotten's innate charm, because Joseph Cotten, by most people's standards, not particularly a great looking guy, certainly no Cary Grant or, you know, Errol Flynn or any of the other leading men at the time, but he had a definite charm to him. I mean, he's kind of the in Citizen Kane, he's really the audience surrogate. He's the most sort of normal guy there. And like I said, I've always loved him. I've loved him in these movies. And he had a career all the way up until the very early 80s, giving really interesting performances in, like, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte and The Abominable Dr. Fibes. And as we mentioned, The Third Man. He was in Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, for Pete's sake. So, I mean, really interesting guy. And I just, again, I enjoy watching him, even though he is, of course, a sadistic murderer. He's not sympathetic at all.
Yeah, I've always wondered in Fibes, because that's so campy. Like, if at any point he said, I was in Citizen Kane, like, what am I doing here? You know, he also was the guy who is killed at the beginning of Soylent Green that ends up being,
that's right! That oh, I forgot up, he's in that, yeah.
Yeah, he ends up being, like, the impetus for Charlton Heston to do this big investigation. So I've just loved his career from the very beginning. So, again, as you say, just another reason for me to love this movie.
Yeah, it really is terrific. And you could say, I would love to have read more about why Hitchcock says this is his favorite. I just saw the quote saying that, yes, it's his favorite, but the quotes I saw, he doesn't get into why. I would love to know why, because except it's great. It's a masterpiece. It's just, in a career full of masterpieces, some of the lesser masterpieces just get drowned out a little. But this is, you know, an amazing, and you think this was only a couple of years into Hitchcock's American career. I mean, he'd only come to America, I think, in 36 or 37. So, and I mean, he cranked out a lot of movies between now and then, but, you know, pretty good to be knocking out films this good in that early on. 1943 is when you think that most of his Hitchcock's most famous films are pretty much from the 50s and early 60s.
Yeah. You know, again, this ranks in sort of like my top three or four of Hitchcock films that are my favorites. But a lot of the ones I like are these early ones. My favorite one of his is actually Rebecca. So,
That's an even earlier one. Yeah,
that's even earlier than this. But this one, I just thought there's so many layers to think about as you watch it. And so it seems like every time I watch it, I go, hey, this time I'm going to sort of concentrate on that small town versus evil, or this one I'm going to concentrate on Charlie against Charlie. And so there's always sort of some new wrinkle that you can kind of pick up that just makes it very engaging.
Yeah, there is one scene that I wrote down to it. I want to make sure we mention it before we wrap up, because I mean, of course, one of the things that's great about Hitchcock is his wit, his black humor. I mean, all of his films have a real, you know, dark sense of humor. Even Psycho and stuff, they all have their own kind of thing. And there's a scene here where, near the end of the movie, where it's pretty much Uncle Charlie has revealed to young Charlie. They each know who they are. She knows that Uncle Charlie's a murderer, and Charlie knows that she knows he's a murderer. And she runs off into the street, and he follows her, and he takes her to a bar called the Till 2 Club, again with the duality, the Till 2. And they go to this bar, and of course, they have to pretend everything is normal because they're in a public situation. And they're sitting at this booth, and everything's very strained, and an old friend of young Charlie shows up named Louise, who is now waiting tables. And this waitress, I laugh so hard at this scene, because this waitress is completely defeated by life, and she's working at this bar, and she doesn't like it, and she just goes on and on and on about her life to Charlie, who could not care less, because Charlie is sitting a table across from a murderer, and this has now just been revealed between the two of them, and this waitress just keeps talking about how miserable her life is and what a bad job this is. And the scene goes on so long, I just pictured Hitchcock laughing his ass off behind the camera. Because this is like a bit player, this actress. Her name is Janet Shaw, is playing Louise Finch. I've never heard of Janet Shaw, but she goes on and on and on. I could just picture Hitchcock just telling her, just keep talking. Just keep going, because it's – and he just stretches it out so much. And I just like – I was hoping that this woman had a longer career, because she's so terrific in this one scene. And she was in a bunch of other movies, nothing terribly big past the 1940s, which is too bad, because she is so funny. And I just feel like that's Hitchcock. That is completely Hitchcock's sense of humor coming through in this character.
Yeah, you know, it does go on so long that you kind of say, like, you know, after a while, you're sitting there, you're saying, like, am I missing the point?
Yeah.
Right? But I also think that, again, she is just worn down by life at a very young age. She was a schoolmate of
right. She's the same age as Charlie.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so, as opposed to living in this nice idyllic house with her family, she's like stuck waiting tables. And she does talk about her problems as they're as you say, as they're talking about this serial killing spree. And so it just again shows, like, boy, even small town problems are not really problems. You know, there's one of the key bits of evidence is this ring that Uncle Charlie has given Charlie that
has
an engrave on the inside from one of the murder victims. And at one point the waitress sees it and goes, I'd kill somebody for that ring. And you go, that is just so perfect, right? It is. You chuckle, and then you go, I'm laughing at, you know, purloined jewelry from somebody who's been murdered.
Yeah.
So it is very classic Hitchcock.
Yeah, I could just imagine him sitting in his chair, just probably falling asleep, because apparently he tended to do that, laughing and just wait, you know, just thinking this is just the greatest thing, because it's pure Hitchcock. To me, it is like his obsessions come to the forth of circumventing what you're expecting. You know, it's this tense scene, and it's delayed by this woman who just doesn't get that nobody cares what she's talking about. And I was like, oh man, yeah, this is such perfect Hitchcock. So yeah, it's a wonderful movie. I mean, it's not a surprise. It's Hitchcock. I can't think of a movie he made that wasn't at least interesting. But it really.
Can I insert? There's one more thing that I thought was funny. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, of course, go right ahead.
But, you know, in that scene where the cops are playing reporters, the same sort of thing happens where the mother is going on and on about how to make a cake.
Oh, I want to make a cake, right, yeah.
You know, you can't put in the eggs first. The eggs have to go in second, and I can't let them sit. They have to be folded in the right way. And the whole time you can see these guys practically rolling their eyes. It's the same thing. It's this endless right. discussion about cake making
That's
as
right.
they're trying to, like, find out where Joseph Cotton is and can they get a picture of him. And so there, it just adds so much into the quaint town versus crime thing.
Yeah, you're gonna want to come back tomorrow to get pictures because the cake will be baked by then. And the photographer's like, I'm gonna want to do that. She just does not get it. These two are so totally fake. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. It's just wonderful all around from beginning to end. And like I said, the two lead performances are terrific, and the side ones with McDonald Carey and Henry Travers, Patricia Collins, and Hume Cronin, who obviously made quite an impression on Hitchcock because he used him several times after this, is great in it as the weird Herbie Hawkins. He's just a strange dude with these Coke bottle glasses, and he's obsessed with murder.
Obsessed with murder. You wonder, you know, if there was another movie where he was going to be the serial killer.
Yeah, he definitely has that sort of bead on him. So, it's a wonderful movie. Is there anything else we wanted to talk about this, Ange, before we wrap up?
You know, there's one other thing that if you watch the movie, there's a lot of close-ups of people's hands, which I think is sort of another interesting thing that you can sort of focus on. So Cotton, at one point, like I said, is like his hands are shaking like he's going to throttle her. At one point, he's wringing a napkin in that restaurant scene.
Right. He's like,
as if like I'm going to like snap your neck. And then at the end scene, of course, we haven't even mentioned how it ends. You know, he falls out of a train and gets killed. As he's struggling with young Charlie, there's a lot of close-ups of her hand and his hand holding on to things. And so I've never really quite understood, you know, if that was just he decided he was going to have that be a focus or if it has a bigger meaning. But it's definitely another thing that when I watch it, I kind of look for.
Yeah, there's a scene where he sees young Charlie through a window and he's in his room and you pan down and he's clenching his hands in anger because he's so, you know, he's got such murderous rage for sweet little Teresa Wright.
Yeah.
Which, again, he used very effectively. I mean, we kind of talked about that Teresa Wright seems very innocent, and she does take quite a dark turn when she threatens him. And like you said, I do believe her when she says, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Gene Tierney. Gene Tierney would have been a little old for this part, but it isn't unbelievable that Gene Tierney could have killed somebody, because she does in other movies, but having Teresa Wright do it, that's a shock. I mean, it's almost like Shirley Temple, having Shirley Temple try and kill somebody. You just can't, you know, that's a very genre-busting role for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and these great performances, and I'm just, Teresa Wright and Joseph Cotton are wonderful together, and it's a shame they never got to do any other movies together, because they said they make an interesting couple, despite their adversarial through the second half of the movie. So anybody should see Shadow of Doubt. We've all given it away, but who cares? It doesn't matter. I don't think it's a shock to anybody that the murderer doesn't get away with it at the end of a Hitchcock movie. I mean, you know, it's not a big shock to anybody. But Shadow of a Doubt is really, really terrific. And if you've seen a lot of Hitchcock movies but you haven't seen that one, make the effort to see it, because it's really, really good. So I guess we're going to wrap it up here for Shadow of a Doubt. Ange, thank you so much for doing the show, and thank you for suggesting this movie. I was really happy. I hadn't seen it in decades, so it was really fun to go to watch it again.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for inviting me, and I'll send you another list of other old movies that I love.
Awesome. So before we sign off, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter on Dr. Ange 70, and that's where I do most of my social media. I run a Supergirl blog called Comic Box Commentary, and I'm also one of the Legion of Super Bloggers, so you can look for me there as well.
Very nice. And as always, if you want to send the show an email, it's firewaterpodcast@conquest.net. You can find this and all our other shows featuring our all-star roster of podcasters over at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can use our Twitter address is @FWPodcasts, and the show's Twitter address is @FilmAndWaterPod. So again, Ange, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I want everybody to stay tuned, because we're going to do some listener feedback. Thank you again for doing the show, and we'll have you back on soon.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Star Wars, give me those Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars, don't let them end. Star Wars, those near and far Wars, talking about Star Wars on a podcast.
I'm Ryan Daly, and welcome to...
And I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
Dude, what are you doing?
What?
Give Me Those Star Wars is my show.
Well, you're part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, so it's really our show.
But if you show up on the promo, people will think you're the co-host.
I'm not?
No, the show will have rotating guests.
You just took that idea from my Justice League International podcast.
You took that idea from my Secret Origins podcast.
And you took that idea from Dead, Both, and Spies.
That was my podcast.
Wait a minute. I sang the theme song with you.
So?
So, technically, I appear on every episode. I'm part of the foundation of this new Star Wars show.
That's true.
So, you want to take this from the top, or what?
I'm Ryan Daly. Join me and a galaxy of guest stars on Give Me Those... including the Irredeemable Shag, whose voice you will technically hear on every episode, on Give Me Those Star Wars.
The official Star Wars show of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Available on iTunes and Stitcher and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Star Trek. Comic books. Mythology. Video games. Toys. Star Wars. Just about any geeky topic you can think of could be covered on the Hammer Podcast, presented by two true freaks. Come join me, Gene Hendricks, for whatever my disjointed mental processes can come up with, and be careful, or you might just learn something before we're done. The Hammer Podcast is available monthly, both on its own iTunes feed and at twotruefreaks.com.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Hey everyone, as promised, we are going to do listener feedback. So we're going to go all the way back to episode 25, which was Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And our pals Chris and Cindy Franklin wrote in to say, I'm pretty sure I saw this film once, I have to assume this is Chris, once years ago, during the many marathon cycles of movie rentals my friends and I used to take in. It was probably too much of a downer to make it into repeat rental rotation. But now I really want to watch it again. I'll add it to the Film and Water film list I have going. That's great, Chris. I think you'll love it. Sisquared wrote in, one of my favorite 70s films ever. I saw it in French dub on TV as a kid, and it freaked me out. That final scream stayed with me, and when I thought my blog would mostly be comic book reviews, my terrifying rating featured Donald Sutherland, one of the few celebs in my province, I might add, pointing with mouth open. The film keeps surprising me each time I watch it, and again, listening to you guys talk about it, Nathaniel is always very good when he talks about movies, so we'll have him on again, because I somehow forget all the little upsetting details between viewing and discover them all over again. Great choice. Yes, it's quite, I completely agree with that. To me, it is, as I said at the time, it's a film that stays fresh how many times you've seen it. And I agree, Nathaniel did a great job, and he will absolutely be back on. Regarding episode 26, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Chris Franklin again, he says, never saw this film, but it sounds interesting. I watched The Hunger for the first time a few years ago, and man, I really regret missing that in my teen years. Before that, my only real exposure to Bowie the actor was Labyrinth and The Prestige. I would agree with David that his presence did elevate those projects. He had just that it quality. Whether you're a huge fan or not, he was always interesting. You either have it or you don't, and he had it in spades. Yeah, that's absolutely true, Chris. Siskoid said, I'm glad you went with this rather than the more obvious Labyrinth, even though I'd seen it more recently. I'd say its most obvious successor, or premise-wise, is Starman. Tone-wise, how about the Flaming Lips' Christmas on Mars? He says, and I feel you, David. Don't be ashamed of your emotionality here. Not that Bowie's death affected me this much, but I'll still tear up at the thought of Elizabeth Sladen's or more recently Leonard Nimoy's. These are artists who touched our lives and whose work is intimately connected with our identities. Regarding my David Gutierrez's suggestion of the Kelly on Kelly show, Siskoid says, don't know about the Kelly show, but Grace Kelly will appear on my Grace on Grace podcast, along with Grace Jones, computer scientist Grace Hopper, and Grace Sherwood, the Witch of Pungo, 1660 to 1740. So, okay. Regarding episode 27, Blazing Saddles, which I did with Chris, Siskoid says, while I'll never have the connection you have to Blazing Saddles, my first and most impactful Mel Brooks film was Young Frankenstein, I love listening to you guys talk about it. He says, as for Westerns as a genre, I must say I'm a bit of a fan, but only when they are revisionist in tone. That does include Leone, but also Peckinpah, and a lot of latter-day stuff. The first Western I fell in love with, however, was Tombstone. And then my host for that episode, Chris Franklin, responded, I love Tombstone too, Siskoid. My college roommate played the VHS over and over upon its initial release. My first real Western I fell in love with was The Outlaw Josie Wales, still my personal favorite Eastwood film. Over on the Fire and Water Facebook page, Ronnie Ling said, love the podcast, was pissing myself remembering this great flick. What a compliment. I will be getting my DVD out and watching it again this weekend. Wish it was coming back to the big screen down here. Happy trails. And then David Tony wrote in, great podcast. Of course, I listened to it the night of the last showing of Blazing Saddles on the big screen. Dang it. If I was not so lazy, I wouldn't put that clang sound, right, as David said that. But you'll just have to imagine it in your head. Jeff Nettleton wrote in, and he had a lot of comments, which he always does, which is terrific. I'm just going to read a little bit of them here. He says, greatly enjoyed the discussion of Blazing Saddles. I didn't get to see it until I was a teenager, but I distinctly remember seeing the TV spots as a kid and the movie poster at the local cinema. I knew there was supposed to be something dirty about it, but all I knew was Alex Karras punching a horse. I can't even remember a piece on either – I can remember – a piece on a morning talk show or the network news where they showed footage of the horse reacting to a trainer's cue to drop to the ground to prove that Mongo didn't actually punch the horse. It's staggering to believe that anyone could believe an actor would really do that, but then you remember the tripwire that were used on horses in old Hollywood, and you do sometimes wonder if the stunt was safe for the horse. This film works on so many levels, and as Chris pegs it, it is a Bugs Bunny played edgier. It is enormously quotable, as I have used the what in the wide world of sports is going on in here at work, often to dumbfounded blinking, as I work with too many youngsters who have neither seen the movie nor have any idea of what wide world of sports was. Don't get me started on their ignorance of Slim Pickens. Yeah, Slim Pickens, funny guy. Yeah, the wide world of sports. That line never is not funny. Jose Rivera wrote in to say, hey, I love the Blazing Saddles episode. My sisters and I grew up with Spaceballs and the later Mel Brooks movies. When we were a little older, our parents decided to show us Blazing Saddles, followed by Young Frankenstein. That's a twofer. I think I was 14 when I first saw this movie and absolutely loved it. To this day, the Mongo-like candy line cracks me up. What impresses me the most about this movie is the various types of comedy there are. You have physical comedy, social comedy, slapstick comedy, musical comedy, meta-comedy, and so on. And they all work. No form steps on the other. So glad you did this episode. It made me break out my Blu-ray, and my family and I watched it. Chuck Coletta wrote in to say, I really enjoyed the Blazing Saddles discussion. I was aware of Mel Brooks's When Things Were Rotten TV series about Robin Hood, starring Dick Gautier, but had never heard of Black Bart. After a quick Google search, I found it on YouTube. It pales in comparison and is obviously missing Mel's input. And Chuck actually sent me the link to it on YouTube, which I have yet to watch. Apparently, it's also included on the Blazing Saddles Blu-ray DVD, which is like that's like a great little bonus. I love that. I will have to watch it because I am curious as to how you could even make a Mel Brooks TV show, considering, especially one of Blazing Saddles. It's so foul-mouthed. Young Frankenstein I could see, because that's pretty PG, but Blazing Saddles. And then finally, Bradley Mann wrote in regarding Blazing Saddles. I love this film. How many films can be both called racist and progressive? Loved your coverage. Regarding episode 28, which is The Adventures of Robin Hood, Kyle Benning wrote in to say, stellar episode, Robin Jean. Like both of you, my introduction in this film was likewise Rabbit Hood. Arise! And ever since I first saw that cartoon when I was probably 4 or 5, I had always been intrigued by the film that the live-action portion came from. I was finally able to sit down and watch it for the first time a couple of years ago and instantly fell in love with it. Gorgeous, gorgeous film. They just don't make them like they used to. Growing up, the Kevin Costner Robin Hood was a mainstay in our household, but this 1938 classic easily eclipses it. I'm sorry you guys never mentioned the Nazi spy sympathizer allegations that were levied against Errol Flynn for decades. In fact, the rumors were so prominent and so widely believed that in the 1991 movie The Rocketeer, one of my personal favorites, that the villain of the piece, the movie star, secret Nazi, Neville Sinclair, played by Timothy Dalton, is supposed to be an Errol Flynn analog. When the script was being drafted, The Rocketeer, figure had been in product hell since the mid-1980s, the rumors of Flynn's Nazi ties were still running rampant and widely believed. It wasn't until the late 80s or 90s, after the script was already approved and the movie moved into production, that Flynn's heirs succeeded in fully clearing Flynn's name. A great moment in the Rocketeer film is on set, in the middle of a swashbuckling sword fight that Neville Sinclair stabs the actor he's sparring with. After hearing the anecdote about the sharply sword tips that Rob shared, I can't help but get an even deeper appreciation of that scene in Rocketeer. They really went all out to invoke the parallels to Flynn. Great episode. I really enjoyed all 28 of these fantastic Film & Water episodes. Can't wait to hear what you cover next. And hey, if you want to cover the Rocketeer, obviously I'm interested. You know, Kyle, that's interesting. I have not seen The Rocketeer, I think, since I saw it in the theater, which was 1991. So you're talking about 25, 26, 27 years ago. So that might be worth revisiting. That's an interesting suggestion. I will be in touch. Earth2Chris wrote in to say, what a great episode about one of my favorite films. All Robin Hood adaptations begin and end here, although I do like Disney's animated take. And okay, I'll admit it, the costume version is a guilty pleasure, but they have yet to top this classic. When you're talking myths and legends, Gene brings the thunder. Always great to hear him on his show, and he drops some knowledge here for sure. Rob, I totally agree with you on Robin Hood and similar heroes being the gateway to standard literature from comics. As a kid, I was aware of Robin Hood, but I remember getting a copy of the Best of DC Digest number 26, featuring old Brave and Bold reprints, including Robin Hood. That really turned me on to the character, and as soon as I was spending a lot of my time in my school library reading any Robin Hood book I could find, and also firing lots of suction cup arrows in my backyard. I'm also happy to report that both my kids like this film and have watched it with me numerous times. It does indeed hold up. Jeff Nettleton wrote in and said, so this is a favorite movie? Well, let me paint a picture of where I'm writing this. My computer room contains my library filled with novels of mystery, fantasy, adventure, and history, graphic novels and trade paperbacks and various references and art photo books. On the walls of this room are a few images, a reproduction of the N.C. Wyeth cover of Treasure Island, the movie poster of the Richard Lester version of The Three Musketeers, the movie poster for Tyrone Powers' The Mark of Zorro. Then on opposing walls are a sketch of Robin Hood drawn by Mike Grell and the poster of The Adventures of Robin Hood. I love swashbucklers. As you say, they are the DNA of superheroes. This is the greatest adventure movie of all time. A nice bookend to this film is the more serious Robin and Marian with Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn. This is Robin at the end of his life, who has become disenchanted with service in Richard's army and the slaughter of the Crusades. Marian attempted to take her life after Robin left, survived, and joined a convent. They are brought back together, and Robin leads one last battle against the sheriff, King John, and his latest oaf. Robert Shaw is the sheriff, and he has even greater respect for Robin, but still does his duty. It's a great, seldom-seen film. It is far more serious and cynical, though, but living legends rarely age well. Over on the Facebook page, Forrest Green wrote in to say, great name, Forrest Green. It sounds like it's right out of Robin Hood. There's a great scene in The Longbow Hunters where Oliver is talking about meeting Howard Hill, the real-life archer that did all the shots in the film that we talked about. He says, Oliver had a painting based on this poster hanging where he lived with Dinah in Seattle. And you see that in the Facebook page. Yeah, it's that beautiful poster that Mike Grell drew for Robin Hood. And, of course, it's perfect that Green Arrow, his favorite film would be Robin Hood, of course. Regarding episode 29, which was our Oscar talk with Zaki Hassan, Ryan Daly from Give Me Those Star Wars wrote in to say, I also loved Creed, but I would love to see Ryan Coogler rewarded with a directing nomination over, say, someone like Adam McKay. David Ace Gutierrez took issue to my my Stallone bashing. We said, why all the Cobra jabs? Maybe you're the disease, Rob Kelly, and John Cobra Cobretti is the cure. You know, David, if you want to come on and talk about the Stallone oeuvre of the 80s, I'll be happy to have you on the show. Siskoid says, like you, I know full well the Oscars are no better and maybe worse than other award galas, but watching them is a sacred tradition. Our annual Oscar party has evolved into as big a production at home as it is on television. It's got these $5,000 gift bags. Winning the Oscar pool means you get a ton of used and new DVDs that participants are getting rid of or have bought special to troll the winner. There's a potluck where all the foods are movie puns. My entry this year is probably going to be the Brie, quote, Larson shrooms. Many obey a non-existent dress code, and we do try to see as many nominated films as we can, regardless of category, together beforehand, around 20 to date. As for Oscars So White, good points made on both sides of the argument with the truth somewhere in the middle. While it's true that the lack of diversity in nominations, and I also wonder what the male-female ratio would be if awards were given to actors, regardless of gender, is indicative of a systemic industry failure to give people of color, in front and behind the camera, as much in the way of opportunity. It's also true to say that voters come with a bias concerning black or Latino or Asian, etc. culture. I'm not saying it's racism, mind you. It's that to understand, really understand, a minority when you are a member of the opposite majority, you must make a conscious, empathetic effort. If you don't, if you thoughtlessly look at everything through your own culture or gender or whatever, culture's eyes, you may miss the value of the minority's narrative. In other words, your median Academy member who is male, white, and of a certain age does not get why the rise of gangster rap is so important or what the story of NWA is about because he lacks the cultural touchstones to even generate interest in it. That voter, unless he makes an active effort, doesn't even have the tools to evaluate a performance like Corey Hawkins's or Jason Mitchell's in Straight Outta Compton. I don't have any solutions here, and it's a bit of a vicious circle. While voters essentially elect new voters with each new award, and if they make their own kind win, the pool of white voters grows, and so on. Nobody wants to see tokenism, least of all the people nominated, but my own litmus test reveals that minority candidates do get snubbed. Basically, if there's someone on a list of nominees that makes me go, really? While a sure shot candidate doesn't figure on it, that's suspect. Last year, Bradley Cooper had no business being nominated for American Sniper, while David Oliello, you know what I'm saying, who had no business not being nominated in the same category for Selma, to name one of the more blatant examples. A minority caucus or slot that ensures representation at the nomination stage would probably be my fix, and there are various ways to do that. After that, vote for who you want, but minorities are getting face time, and their presence changes the way we think of the industry and its biggest award show, and that gets the ball rolling. Anyway, good show, and I'll see you on the red carpet. Yeah, Cisco, you had a lot of great ideas there, and I was really appreciative that a lot of people commented on that part of the discussion of the show, because I think it's an important thing. I mean, yeah, it's an award show, but it is part of the culture, and it is part of the preeminent entertainment forms, you know, basically their prom, and it's important to cover these things. And so, yeah, I think a lot of those things you suggested are quite good. Diablo Frank, regarding this topic, the Oscars So White, over on Facebook, on Twitter, at Commander Blanks, sent out a couple of tweets where he mentioned, clearing out aging white decades unproductive Academy members strengthens minority voice, especially in more diverse modern pool. He mentions that someone made, Dustin Rolls, I'm not too familiar with that is, he says, made a great point of exactly what the difference is between Academy winner Walk the Line and Straight Outta Compton, color. He also said, I want Jennifer Jason Leigh to get her career award. She deserves it, and it would help her keep her getting worthy parts. Conversely, no word for Stallone's long career of terrible performances. Oscar equals a slap in the face to the profession. I'm going to say Zaki Hassan would disagree with you with that one, Frank. We got an email from Chuck Coletta again, and this was just about the show in general. He says, hey, Rob, I assume you've probably heard of Joe Dante's Show from Hell website. Somehow I never knew of it until it was mentioned on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast. It's a great film lover's rabbit hole to tumble into. And then he sent the link. Yeah, I am very familiar with Trailers of Hell. In fact, I've seen every single one. I've spent many hours on the site just watching. And for anyone who doesn't know, it's a site that features film directors, as we just mentioned, Joe Dante, screenwriters, actors, writers, editors, pretty much anybody who's in the film business in one way or the other, doing audio commentary for trailers of films they like or in some cases don't like. There's Joe Dante and John Landis and Edgar Wright and Josh Olson and Larry Karaszewski, who co-wrote Ed Wood. It's a really fun site. I love it. The minute I get a email warning that there's a new trailer post, I go and I watch it. I love it. And my dream is to somehow do something in life that qualifies me to be on that site and just pick a trailer and talk over it. I think that would be like life achievement unlocked. So far, at this age, hasn't happened yet, but I'm not giving up hope. I would love to be a talking head on a Trailers from Hell trailer. That would just be awesome. Yeah, I love that site. It's super, super fun. And over on Twitter, we get a lot of action. And I really appreciate it. I'm going to mention those who have retweeted the show's messages, and they are The Lady Jessica, Trekker Talk, BoldOutlaw.com, Warlord Worlds, Between the Pages, Where Pop Culture and Food Meet, which is Between the Pages, Two True Freaks, Siskoid, The Hammer Strikes, Dr. G Nerdologist, PladStallions.com, Keith G. Baker, Cord Industries, Craig 101, JSlab 425, David Gutierrez, Coffee and Comics Blog, Siskoid again. Well, I didn't edit this list carefully enough. Michael Wagner, Nathaniel Wayne, and Count Druncula. Thanks, everybody, for mentioning the show and listening and downloading it. I really, really appreciate it. This is super fun to do. I'm really excited that we are now on our own full-on site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And I should mention this, too. The Film & Water Podcast now has its own Twitter feed. Of course it does. Has its own iTunes feed. So you can go to iTunes and search for Film & Water Podcast, and there it is. I'll have all the shows. So as the main feed of Fire & Water is going to contain all the shows, if there are some shows in there you don't necessarily want to hear, you can now subscribe to each of the shows individually. We haven't got them all going on their own feeds yet, but Film & Water does. So you can go and listen. You can subscribe to this separate feed, which is coming from the Film & Water Podcast site. And you can also go to, of course, the iTunes page for the Film & Water Podcast and leave reviews. We have been very, very, very fortunate with how many great reviews we've gotten for Fire & Water Podcast. We're over 100, which is tremendous. Shag and I really appreciate it. There are a lot of movie podcasts, and the Film & Water Podcast is just, of course, you know, not terribly famous, and that's fine. I do it for fun. I'm not really worried about it. But, of course, I would love more people to hear it, and part of the way we do that is reviews. So if any of you are so inclined, please go to the iTunes page for Film & Water Podcast and leave us a review. Leave me a review. Leave the show a review. And hopefully we'll get some higher ratings, and we'll be able to populate to closer high up to when people are searching for movie podcasts. So I guess that's going to wrap it up. We've done the feedback. I want to thank Ange again for coming on. That was a lot of fun, and we'll absolutely be back. As I mentioned, the email is firewaterpodcast@conquest.net, and the Twitter feed is @filmandwaterpod, and you can listen to all the shows at the site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope you had fun. Until next week, that's a wrap.
Why'd you bring me in here?
What does it matter where we are?
Hello, Charlie. Hello. Oh,
hello, Louise.
Charlie, this is Louise Finch.
Hello.
Glad to meet you.
This is my Uncle Louise.
I was in Charlie's class in school. I sure was surprised to see you come in. I never thought I'd see you here. I've been here 2 weeks. Lost my job over at Kern's. I've been in half the restaurants in town. What'll you have, Charlie?